Good morning and welcome to Behind the Headlines, the Friday morning Utah News Roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard all over the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, President Joe Biden will take action today to restore Utah's Bears Ears and Grand Staircase Escalante National Monuments, monuments that were downsized by former President Donald Trump. Iron County water managers aim to tap aquifers in Beaver County's Pine Valley to fuel growth in Cedar City, but ranchers and environmentalists and Beaver County itself are not on board with the plan. Plus, a new lawsuit aims to topple Utah's cash-based bail system, a system critics say criminalizes poverty and sways the justice system in favor of the rich. Joining me for this conversation all via the Zoom, we've got Salt Lake Tribune legal affairs reporter Jessica Miller. Good morning, Jessica, and welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning. San Juan County reporter and Report for America core member Zach Podmore is with us as well. And Zach, welcome to you.
Good morning, Roger.
Good morning. And news columnist Robert Gerke. Welcome, Robert. Thanks for being here.
Hey, good morning.
A little bit later in the show, we are going to hear also from public lands and environment reporter Brian Maffley, who, among other things, reported on that Cedar City water deal this week. So stick around for that. And listeners, you can join us with your questions and comments by tweeting to @KCPW, or you can call us up at 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. We will begin with some news that I think was more or less expected. President Joe Biden is today going to take action to undo something that his predecessor did, which was to slash the size of some national monuments, two of them here in Utah. Zach Podmore in San Juan County, am I right to say that this isn't unexpected? And, you know, maybe tell us the basics of what we know so far about what the president will actually do today.
Yeah, this is not a surprise. The timing has always been a little bit in question, but I think both supporters of the monument's restoration and those who didn't want to see an executive order reversing the Trump decision and expanding the monuments back to their original size, both of those, you know, both sides of the debate expected that President Biden would do what he is expected to do in a couple hours here and restore the monument's grand staircase back to just under 1.9 million acres, which it was the size it was when it was created in 1996 by President Clinton, and then Bears Ears back to 1.35 million acres, the size it was when it was created by President Obama in 2016.
Hmm. You know, just focusing in on the latter monument, on Bears Ears, this is a monument that originally a coalition of five tribes had petitioned President Obama for, though they wanted something, I think, bigger than they actually got from President Obama. How is that coalition of tribes responding to the news of the restoration of this monument, I guess of both monuments?
Yeah, the Bears Ears Intertribal Coalition has put out a statement thanking President Biden for taking this action today. They've been pushing, you know, since the coalition was formed in around 2015 for a 1.9 million acre Bears Ears National Monument, and the one that President Obama created in 2016 was considerably smaller than that. There was some hope that there would be an expansion with this decision today, and there is a very small expansion of around 10,000 acres that's expected to happen in Bears Ears, but nothing close to the 1.9 million acre boundaries that some had pushed for. But I'd say the Tribal Coalition is very grateful for Secretary of Interior Deb Haaland and President Biden for, you know, restoring the monument back to its boundaries that that were set several years ago for being reduced by 85% by President Trump.
Yeah, in 2017. And then, you know, on the other side of this, Utah's state leadership and the entirety of Utah's federal delegation they're not so happy about what President Biden is slated to do today. What are they saying about this decision?
That's correct. Yeah, Governor Spencer Cox, the lieutenant governor, and top state lawmakers in the legislature all put out a statement. The entire Utah congressional delegation put out a statement as well, and they both said similar things. They are concerned about a back and forth with the boundaries of this monument, switching with every change of presidential administration. There was a lawsuit filed in 2017 after President Trump made the reductions, but it was never, the lawsuit was never heard. So it's still an open question legally whether or not a president can reduce a monument. So this is a concern that, if Republican comes in a few years to the White House, the monuments could be reduced or rescinded once again, and will always kind of be in this legal limbo. The Republicans in Utah's congressional delegation had advocated for a legislative solution, as they call it, to this issue, congressional protection for the area instead of protection under the Antiquities Act by presidential proclamation. And that's still, of course, possible. No matter what size the monument is, Congress can step in at any time and make the area into a national conservation area or some other congressionally protected designation, which has happened, with places like the Grand Canyon, Arches National Park. They started as monuments and became, congressionally protected later on.
And so Utah's delegation in Washington saying that, Congress is the appropriate venue for this, at least to their minds, and that, and you're pointing out that they can take action. But am I right, though, that a part of the reason, at least in the case of Bears Ears, for the monument declaration was that legislative action, wasn't producing, there were proposals in Congress, but they weren't really going anywhere when it came to creating some sort of status for this land?
That's correct. Yeah, Utah Dene Bakea, the grassroots indigenous group in San Juan County that supported the monument, and later the Bears Ears Intertribal Coalition, both worked first in 2014, 2015, kind of in that range, on a legislative proposal that would have made a national conservation area in the Bears Ears region. And that effort fell apart sometime around 2015, and then the groups pivoted to supporting a national monument declaration before President Obama left office. So this is something, there were hundreds of meetings held as part of this public lands initiative that was led by then Representative Rob Bishop, but they never, got that close to becoming law. So, supporters of the monument say, let's expand it to 1.35 million acres, which is likely to happen today. And then if a legislative alternative comes down the line later, that can be discussed. But they want to see protections on the ground immediately.
Yeah. I mean, you said expand it to 1.35 million acres, but it's really is just putting it back to where it was declared as, right? The 1.35. I guess it depends upon how you look at it. But
yeah, thank you. Yeah, restore it maybe is a better way to put it.
At the state level, Zach, we've been talking about the federal delegation, but Utah state leaders in an email that they sent out yesterday, they said that this decision by President Biden demonstrates the administration's unwillingness to collaborate with or listen to those most impacted by their decisions. And Zach Podmore, it's an interesting statement because at the local level, there are voices that the president is ignoring here, but there are also those that he isn't ignoring. Is that a fair characterization? I mean, is it that he is ignoring people who are most impacted by these decisions, or I guess it's just a matter of perspective?
Yeah, that's a good point. I've seen, that sentiment in numerous statements put out by all sorts of people who are opposed to the decision to restore the monuments today, saying that, in one form or another, that this decision is being made without properly taking into account local voices. And while there are, many opponents of the Bears Ears National Monument in San Juan County, where the monument is located, and Grand County, which is nearby the monument boundaries, there are also many supporters as well. The San Juan County Commission has put out resolutions calling for restoration of the monument to 1.35 million acres and had even hoped for an expansion to 1.9 million acres. Grand County Commission supported a full restoration of the monument. Bluff City Council supported restoration of the monument. The Utah Navajo Commission, the Ute Mountain Ute Tribe, all of these groups or government entities in San Juan County and Grand County had wanted the monument to be restored. So there's a lot of local support for the monument. Blanding and Monticello had put out statements asking for the monument not to be brought back to 1.53 million. So there's local opposition as well, but I'd say it's very divided locally. It's not, clearly that locals are for it or against it.
Going back to, there's a lot of different places we could go, and we've talked about some of these things before, Zach, on the program, but, just focusing again on Bears Ears, a monument requested by Navajo, Ute Mountain Ute, Zuni, Hopi, and Ute tribes. What do we expect when it comes to the implementation of a management plan for Bears Ears National Monument? Like, who will be involved? Who's going to have a seat at the table? Is that going to be decided quickly or even today during this, I guess, is it a signing ceremony that's happening? Maybe you could also fill us in on what's happening, just a little bit later today, Zach.
Yeah, so just before noon, Utah time, maybe around 11:45, President Biden's expected to sign a executive order that uses his authority under the Antiquities Act to restore these two monuments in Utah. And then also a couple monuments in the Northeast as well. The order, these proclamations lay out, in the case of Bears Ears, the tribal co-management or tribal input that is required as the management plans are drawn up for the monument. President Obama had created an advisory committee made up of the Bears Ears Intertribal Coalition members and others that would kind of give their input as the management decisions were being made for the monument. And President Trump's order in 2017 greatly altered that that advisory committee and made it so it was, more, it cut out, according to some of the critics, it cut out some of the tribes that are located in outside of Utah, in Hopi and Zuni in Arizona in particular. So it's expected that President Biden will restore the language in the proclamation to something like what President Obama had, or maybe even strengthen the role that these elected leaders from various Native American nations will play in the decision-making process. That's a little bit of an unknown of exactly what that language is going to look like, but it should be spelled out pretty clearly in the proclamation language in a few hours here.
Okay. Zach, thanks for bringing us up to speed. And I might come back to you with a couple of follow-ups, but let's bring in Robert Gierke from the Opinion Desk, a news columnist for the Tribune. And again, Robert Gierke, not unexpected, but significant news on the Utah public lands beat. Just from your perspective, what is at stake here? Meaning, what does this restoration of these monuments mean?
Well, I mean, I think, as you mentioned, not really a surprise. It was something that he said during the campaign, that President Biden said during the campaign that he would do. First day in office, he signed the order directing the review of the monument, the monuments that had been shrunk by the president, President Trump. So I think, there are a lot of people saying that this is ping-ponging back and forth, that every administration is going to change it. And I think that there needs to be a real effort to try to get some permanence to this. And if that means, legislative, as Zach mentioned, maybe a conservation area, something like that. It's not helpful, I think, to have these monuments designated and then not fund the protection and of these lands. There's the potential actually for it to be detrimental in attracting more visitors to these sites that we're trying to preserve. And so if there's not resources that come behind this proclamation, then it's a little bit pointless, to be honest. So there's got to be a real effort, I think, to get a good quality management plan in place, get funding to enforce and protect some of these lands, and you know, and hopefully preserve them. And also, I think there does need to be some maybe collaboration with locals, because, you know, we were at a point now, Grand Staircase is getting overlooked a little bit by, you know, in this, because Bears Ears is sort of the higher profile of the two. But, you know, that's been in place for almost 25 years now. And you know, there needs to be some permanence and some assurances that that it will continue to be, and that it will, that the resources are going to be preserved. So, yeah, I mean, it's a first step. It's going to be an ongoing process for you know, months and years to come.
Yeah, when the monument was called for by the tribes, they were saying, look, there are historical treasures here, there are artifacts, and there's Native American art, ancient art, and historic settlements. And then, for, as you said, you know, in the case of Grand Staircase, a fossil treasure trove that paleontologists have described there, were those things, though, are they at less risk now, Robert, I guess, than they were, those monuments having been downsized?
I mean, again, it's on paper, I suppose there's some protection for them, but in reality, there isn't, if you don't have funds to hire staff and to actually, you know, do the work. So, yeah, it's a first step, and I think that these resources, these antiquities that they're trying to protect, are still very much at risk if you don't have some mechanism to enforce and protect them.
And then finally, Robert, just the Zach brought up the fact that there were these lawsuits that happened over whether President Trump even had the constitutional authority to downsize the monuments, whether any president has that authority to downsize monuments that have been designated by previous presidents. I guess that question will just be left unresolved for now.
Yeah, it's a little bit unfortunate, actually, that there wasn't some closure to that, because that does enable presumably the next president, or if President Trump is reelected, to do this again, and then it would get litigated again, you know. And so if we could have had an answer on that, then maybe it would have prevented some of this potential for a pendulum effect. But you know, and the state will probably make noise about suing again over the designations. They tried that. Worth noting, over the Grand Staircase back in, you know, in 98, and ended up losing. So it's unlikely that a lawsuit filed by the state would succeed, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they won't try it.
And then, Zach Podmore, just before, I'll come back to you now, just before we head to a break, Robert is talking about, or well, was talking about the having the funding necessary to truly protect these places, you know, to enact the management plan and to hire the staff. Is I guess does the what's happening today envision a massive influx of funding and of the kinds of things that Robert is expressing concern about there?
Yeah, it's an important point. And in 2016, with the designation of Bears Ears originally, there was a big boost of funding to the monument area, to the Monticello Field Office, in kind of then Secretary of Interior Sally Jewell's last weeks in that role. That funding, as far as I understand, has slowly dried up over the last 5 years. But in the White House statement that was put out last night, they spent an entire paragraph talking about how they're going to make sure that there's adequate funding for the region, the hiring of more rangers and law enforcement officers. You know, last I heard, a couple months ago, there was only one law enforcement officer for the entire Monticello Field Office, which is millions of acres, and including all of Bears Ears. So these are resources that are really badly needed. And President Biden is committing to expanding those resources and hiring more staff. So we have yet to see numbers, but yeah, that's part of the commitment. Sure.
Stay tuned. Big news today, an expected action by President Joe Biden, and that's going to happen, as Zach said, just a little bit later this morning. And to restore the size of national monuments in Utah, great reporting from the Tribune on this, who scooped everyone else, local and national, you know, in terms of getting this story out first. So kudos to the Trib on that. And we need to head to our first break in the show. You are listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. When we come back, we'll go to the new lawsuit challenging Utah's cash bail system. Stay with us.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW, Salt Lake Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find podcasts of all of our local programs at kcpw.org. And hey, while you're there, why not make a pledge? Because your contributions power this local, independent, nonprofit outlet. Thanks for listening and for supporting public radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined by Salt Lake Tribune reporters Jessica Miller and Zach Podmore, and by news columnist Robert Gerke. It's our live Friday morning Utah news wrap-up, and you can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255 or tweeting them to @KCPW. Jessica Miller, legal affairs reporter with the Tribune. Utah has a cash-based bail system, and it's a system that over the past few years has received a fair amount of scrutiny. And actually, Jessica, remind us why cash bail has its critics.
So cash bail is essentially, you know, if you're arrested for a crime, you can't get out of jail unless you post bail. And so the criticism of that is that if you are someone who has a lot of money, who has access to a lot of resources, you very easily can make bail and you can leave jail regardless of whether you're actually a public risk or not. It doesn't take into account whether you're dangerous or, you know, whether you could continue criminal activity when you've been released. And then the flip side of that is if you don't have those resources, if you don't have the money to get out of jail, you're stuck. You can't leave jail. And so for people who are poor, even if they're accused of very low level crimes, they can't get out of jail even if they're not really that dangerous, just because they can't afford the price tag to leave.
Right. There are suspects in a case. I mean, there's a presumption of innocence. And while you await your turn at justice, you know, innocent or guilty or whatever, some people can afford to go on with their lives. Others can't. And then there are some persistent repercussions. I mean, if you are stuck in jail and you can't go to work, you might lose your job.
Right, exactly. I mean, even a couple of days in jail for somebody, you know, if they've been arrested and they're waiting for trial, even if it takes them 5 or 6 days to get out of jail, if a judge does release them without having to post bail, I mean, you could lose your job. You know, what happens to your kids? Right. If you lose your job, you have trouble paying rent. There's a whole lot of, you know, waterfall repercussions that happen because someone is incarcerated and simply can't pay to get out.
There is a sort of convoluted story of attempts to reform Utah's cash-based bail system. This is just over the past couple of years, there's been a kind of doing and then undoing of reform. Reminds me a little bit of our National Monument story from earlier. But
right.
Tell us about what's been going on the reform side of things at the legislature, Jessica.
Yeah, it has been it's been pretty confusing. But there was bail reform passed in 2020. And what that did is it didn't totally get rid of this cash-based bail system, but what it did was it added a risk assessment tool. So that now judges are assessing things like, can this person afford this amount? And what is their risk to the community if they're released? And so that hopefully would let people who are poor out, and then people maybe who have resources but are very dangerous, they could be kept in jail if there was a public safety risk. So that was passed in 2020, and then immediately a year later, legislators pretty much undid it. It's been a really hotly debated issue that's really divided police and, you know, police on one side and prosecutors and defense attorneys on the other. And it's still something that's being debated now. But some of those changes, the risk assessment, things like that, that's all been undone this last year, this last legislative session.
What was the driving force behind, or, you know, well, who was the driving force, but also what was the argument being made for undoing those reforms?
So the driving force behind the undoing of the reforms was really the Utah Sheriff's Association and some law enforcement officials. They really came out hard last year with these anecdotal stories of, you know, because of bail reform, this dangerous person was released. You know, because of bail reform, someone got, you know, was in a SWAT standoff and then they were let go. But it's kind of interesting when you looked into the court cases of these anecdotes, a lot of times they didn't actually have to do with bail reform. So it's a little, some of the facts associated with that were in dispute, but it's really been the sheriffs and some of law enforcement in Utah really pushing to say that if we dismantle cash bail system, it's going to lead to more dangerous people being let out.
And that's right. And you said some of the facts are in dispute. I mean, is it true that violent offenders were getting out because of the reforms that were put in place, Jessica? Do we have data on that?
I think there might have been like an anecdote or two, but I don't believe the data showed that like wholesale that was happening. And like I mentioned before, a lot of the cases the sheriff's office were pointing to specifically, you know, we would as journalists fact check that, and it didn't match. I mean, people were being released because of, you know, a host of other different reasons. You know, maybe a prosecutor didn't file charges in time, or, you know, other reasons that had nothing to do with bail reform, but they were using those cases, you know, to tell these dramatic stories of what happens if we don't have cash bail in Utah.
Roger, can I jump in real quick on that?
Yeah, Robert Kirky.
I think Jessica's point is exactly right, that the data was lacking to make the case for repealing this bail reform. Salt Lake County had also done a study, and keep in mind, this reform policy was only in place for a few months, but in that period of time, violent offenders were less likely to get out on bail than before the reform was in place. And so, there's an indication that at least for that short period of time that the bail reform was doing what it was supposed to be doing and keeping potentially violent offenders, from getting out.
Yeah. And again, this is about the amount of money that you have, you know, whether you can afford the bail set by a judge. Jessica, since the reforms were undone, since the reforms that we've been talking about at the legislature were undone, a Utah attorney is now trying a different route to try and effect change, to change things in the bail system, a lawsuit. This is Kara Porter. What is her lawsuit all about?
So this lawsuit involves three people in Southern Utah jails that at the time of the lawsuit was filed earlier this week, they were stuck in jail for things like shoplifting, and they couldn't pay, or one woman couldn't pay a $7,000 bail on a shoplifting charge. Another guy was accused of cutting catalytic converters, and he didn't have the money to post $5,000 bail. And so there's these defendants who are, or sorry, plaintiffs who are stuck in jail because they just can't afford to get out. And so Kara Porter is representing them and has made the argument in her lawsuit that this violates their constitutional rights, that they should be able to have their risk assessed and have whether they can pay assessed by a judge and not simply being given a price tag to get out of jail.
And did they, I guess these three people who are imprisoned, are they, and I'm assuming they're still there, they were at least at the time of your publishing this article, how did they decide to join on to this lawsuit? I know that the Kara Porter, the attorney, she's also trying to make this a class action lawsuit, and maybe you can explain that at the same time, Jessica.
Right. I think that the Kara Porter's law firm for a long time has been strategizing about ways to file a lawsuit like this. They kind of braked a little bit when the state passed those reforms, but then they undid it. And so, you know, here we are again. But Kara and her team, I think, had been reaching out to people who had been in jail because, you know, we're talking about county jails. These are people who haven't been convicted yet. And sometimes the time they are in jail can be, you know, 5 or 6 days, which it's a long time for someone who's incarcerated, but for a lawyer trying to put a lawsuit together, it's really not that much time.
Right.
So I think that she had been in contact with some of the people who are in the jails and, you know, found three people who were currently incarcerated who this situation applied to, and they filed the lawsuit. And I think it's important to note that they're not seeking monetary damage here, that these plaintiffs understand that the goal is to change a system and not to, you know, get a settlement or anything like that.
What is the alternative? I mean, if cash bail is called unconstitutional, if a judge declares that and this lawsuit prevails, what actually happens when someone is jailed for an alleged crime? I mean, you know, however minor or major of a crime that may be, how does the process go forward?
I think there's a couple of different ways. I mean, you look at Salt Lake County, they do still do risk assessments and they have a pretty robust like pretrial service program. So you might, you know, have check-ins with somebody every day and make sure they know where you are, maybe have an ankle monitor, things like that. So that, and they can still do or issue some sort of cash bail if needed. So there's kind of that hybrid version. Or you look at like the federal system, and they don't do bail in the federal system. You either are a risk or you're not. And if, you know, if you're not in jail, then they'll take other methods like ankle monitor, things like that, that I just mentioned, to ensure that you come to court and that you're not a risk to flee or to commit new crimes in the meantime. And so there's definitely other models that are used that have been successful that doesn't rely just on funding, just on cash alone.
Mm-hmm. I want to bring Robert Gierke in, news columnist again. And Robert, you know, this new tactic by Kara Porter to try and change, you know, what cash bail does. Jessica's a reporter, so I can't ask her this question, but you're an opinion columnist. Should the cash-based bail system be, you know, done away with? Is that federal model the way to go? What do you think is the appropriate way to do this?
Well, I think it should. I mean, I don't think that the system should be treating two different people differently based entirely on their financial means. And that's what we've got right now. So I think it's worth looking at what other states have done and are doing. I think it's worth looking at, you know, the impacts over that 4 month period that the reforms were in place, and seeing what actually happened and not what, you know, anecdotally some people said happened. And I think we need to start looking at the motivations of some of the parties involved in this, including the Sheriff's Association and the legislators who were who pushed so aggressively to repeal this, because, you know, I think there is a large bail industry, and there are financial incentives for counties and sheriffs to keep the system in place. So the short answer is yes. I think we do need to do away with it, and we need to start from scratch and rebalance and find the balance between public safety and you know, justice.
Jessica Miller, what happens next here? Meaning, we're waiting for this lawsuit to move forward or not? Basically, just to see, to see what happens. We're going to see whether or not this attempted reform through the courts is going to happen or not.
Right. So with the lawsuit, that will move forward, and they're trying to get it classified as a class action lawsuit, so more inmates in those counties where these three people are incarcerated can join. Kara Porter did say that, you know, if the state doesn't change, she has threatened to file more lawsuits. She said she will, you know, keep going after pretty much every county except for Salt Lake County has this cash bail based system, and she's ready to file litigation as needed. So she's kind of made a threat that more is to come. As far as the legislative side, when Governor Cox signed the bill enacting this, he did promise a special session, but that hasn't happened yet, and it's October, so I'm not sure it will. Maybe it will be something I'm sure will be discussed during this next legislative session in January.
Jessica Miller, legal affairs reporter, thank you for this. I know as well that you need to go and do your job, so as we head to a break here in the show, I will just thank you again for joining us. Thanks for joining, Jessica Miller, the show.
Thank you.
Yeah, we will now take a break, and we'll be back in just a minute with our underplayed stories of the week, and then a look at another project that aims to move water from one part of the thirsty West to another. This is Behind the Headlines. Stay with us.
And again, you're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW Salt Lake Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. Behind the Headlines is just one of our locally produced shows made to inform, engage, and entertain. Go check out our other podcasts and make a pledge at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Zach Podmore and Robert Gierke. This is our Friday morning local news roundup heard on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. And to save time for a recorded segment with the Tribune's Brian Maffley, we will turn now to our underplayed stories of the week. And Robert Gierke, I had meant to ask you about some news that you scooped this week. I wonder if that might be your pick for underplayed story of the week, though. No pressure, but kick us off with a pick for underplayed.
Which one? You mean the medical marijuana one?
I was thinking of the Evan McMullen story.
Oh, the Evan McMullen. Yeah, well, I'll talk about that one. Sure.
Okay.
So, yeah, as you may have heard, Evan McMullen, who ran for president in 2016 as an anti-Trump candidate, has announced that he will run as an independent, opposing Senator Mike Lee in his re-election bid next year. And it's significant because we haven't really had a prominent independent candidate run before. It also, you know, there's at least in theory, you can put together a coalition of, you know, disaffected Republicans, Democrats who want somebody else than Mike Lee, and then independents, and maybe make a race of this. So it'll be interesting to watch. And if he wins, it'd really shake up the two-party system in Utah.
Well, thanks for humoring me with that, with choosing my pick. Let's go to and for that pick for underplayed story, as well as your reporting. Zach Podmore, your choice for underplayed story.
Sure. Yeah, Brian Maffley, who you're about to hear from in a moment here, wrote a story about Utah's largest coal-fired power plant, which is near Delta, Utah. It's scheduled to be shut down in 2025. And, you know, coal plants have been shutting down all across the West at a rapid rate. And in some places, they've left, you know, pretty devastating economic consequences in that path of job losses in communities that are really dependent on a single coal power plant. Utah is trying to, I mean, this particular plant in Utah is trying to lessen that blow by transitioning the plant to hydrogen power. So they're trying to store hydrogen in salt domes underground and use that to use the infrastructure that's already in place to produce power in a way that doesn't create carbon dioxide. So it'll be interesting to watch to see how well that works and whether it's can be repeated elsewhere.
Interesting and fascinating pick. Thanks for that, Zach. I'm going to forego my pick in the interest of time and just say to Zach and Robert, thank you so much for joining me on Behind the Headlines today. Zach Podmore and Robert Gierke with the Salt Lake Tribune.
Thanks, Robert.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Now on the show, we're going to turn to my conversation with Tribune Public Lands and Environment reporter Brian Maffley, speaking about another project to move water around in the West. Take a listen. Brian, you and I have talked about projects to move water from one place to another, you know, more than a few times over the years. And this week you reported on a project that aims to import water to the Cedar City area. And just before we get to this water pipeline project itself, where does Cedar City, you know, where does its water come from right now?
Yeah, so Cedar City gets its water from the Central Iron County Water Conservancy District, which has for years been pumping groundwater from Cedar Valley. And they've figured that they're over pumping to the tune of about 7,000 acre feet of water a year. And as a result, it's called mining groundwater. They're extracting more water out of the ground than is being replenished by nature. And as a result, in some places, the ground is sinking. And there's some places like around subdivisions have had to get abandoned. It's been a real problem for some areas. So the solution is, this is the story of the West, is get water from somewhere else and bring it over to you where you need it.
So what's the plan then? What are they going to do? Or what do they want to do?
Yeah, so, well, first of all, Cedar City's growing like crazy, like a lot of urban areas in Utah in general. And it's very close to St. George, which is now its own metropolitan area. It might even be included in that. And to sustain that growth, you obviously need water. So what they want to do, and they've gotten approval from the state of Utah in terms of the water rights, is to take several thousand acre feet of water from underground water from Pine Valley and Wawa Valley, which are two big, extremely dry to the northwest of Cedar City, maybe about 60, 70 miles. So they'll drill these wells, bring up the water, and then run it through a pipeline across BLM land to Cedar City. That's the plan in a nutshell. And part of that is the water would be to serve the residents of Cedar City and other towns, and also replenish the groundwater that's been mined from under Cedar Valley.
So this is, again, Pine Valley and Wawa Valley is to the northwest of Cedar City. This is kind of not that far from the Nevada border. You don't have to look hard to find people who are very upset about this proposal. And for example, you know, people who live from the land in question in Beaver County, where this water would come from, you spoke to a rancher named Mark Winch.
Yeah.
And he's not happy with this. Tell us about Mark Winch and what he said to you, Brian.
Yeah. So Mark Winch, he's a prominent cattleman. He used to be last year he was the president of the Utah Cattlemen's Association, longtime rancher in Wawa Valley, which is the valley next to Pine Valley. He has been active in opposing this project, as has been the Beaver County Commission. And their concern is that if you start pumping all this groundwater out of Pine Valley, it's going to basically dry up the springs, not only in Pine Valley, but in neighboring valleys, because they're all hydrologically connected. And, you know, they look to studies by the U.S. Geological Survey that have pegged the amount of available groundwater at far less than what the Central Iron County Water District plans to pump. So they feel like they have enough information to convince them that they have a lot to worry about. And so the state engineer who approved this water right has, you know, set some safeguards in place that, well, if, you know, we'll do the monitoring, and if it appears that the pumping of groundwater is not sustainable, in other words, more water is being removed than is being replaced by nature, then we'll, you know, adjust this pumping plan or put an end to it. And, you know, the Beaver County Commission and others have said, you know, once they built $250 million worth of infrastructure and have begun pumping groundwater, and Cedar City now depends on that water, they're not going to stop pumping groundwater. And so their feeling is they don't have much faith in these safeguards that the state has imposed on this water right. They feel like once the pumping is started, it's not going to stop. They feel like their quality of life is being sacrificed to support urban sprawl in Iron County.
Environmentalists are none too happy about this either. For this story, you spoke with Kyle Rornick with the Great Basin Water Network.
Yeah.
Tell us about what he says.
Yeah, the Great Basin Water Network and the Utah Rivers Council, both those environmental groups are fighting this proposal. And what they're saying is Iron County could expand their water supply by improving water conservation measures. So far, the state engineer hasn't gone along with that argument. They feel that if Iron County is to meet its future needs, they need to, quote unquote, diversify its water sources. In this case, it means getting it from another county. But their main argument is that, you know, Cedar City can do a lot more with converting agriculture water to municipal uses and just do a better job of conserving water at home. And then the number one argument they're raising is, hey, to pay for this project, you're going to have to increase water rates by 300% to 800%. And the difference in those figures depends on where you live. It appears that the rates will go up differently for different service areas. So what they're saying is, look, if people are going to start having to pay that much more for water, they're just going to be more careful about how they use it and use less. And so how they're faulting, in this case, the Bureau of Land Management, who's put out an environmental impact statement. They've completed it. They just haven't released it. What they're saying is that environmental review has failed to account for the water savings that will likely result from increased water rates. That's a pretty powerful argument, I think, because water is just so cheap in Utah that there is no, you know, price signal. If you're paying, you know, 4 or 5 times more for it, yeah, you're going to think twice before, you know, watering your lawn at 1 p.m. when it's 100 degrees out.
I don't know if we've talked a lot other than, you know, about ranchers who may suffer and about Beaver County in general that opposes it, about the impacts in these valleys of drawing the water out of them. Can you tell us what's being said there?
Well, this is an interesting case where the interests of environmentalists and endangered species activists and conservative ranchers all kind of coincide here. You know, the other group that's weighed in here is the Center for Biological Diversity, which in response to this proposal has filed a petition to list a little fish called the least chub for endangered species status. What they're afraid is that if you start pumping all this groundwater, it's going to degrade the surface water supplies to the point where it's going to, you know, dry up this landscape and impact these kind of rare species, not just fish, but plants, other kinds of wildlife. And that the state of Utah is kind of turning a blind eye to that possibility. Just, you know, they, and there's a lot of wishful thinking that there's plenty of water under the ground to support Iron County's needs. There's really not a lot of evidence to support that at this time. If you consider what the Federal Geological Survey had to say about it, that it's inevitable that what happened in Cedar Valley could very well happen in Pine Valley. That is, more water is taken out of the ground than can be replaced. Springs dry up, the ground starts subsiding, and then you can't build on it, which is what's happened in around towns like Enoch. So groundwater pumping is going to become more and more prevalent as the surface water supplies dry up because of climate change. And we're seeing that already in Arizona, which is, you know, a lot of their farmers are getting cut off because of these this water shortage that was declared on the Colorado River. So what are they going to do? Well, let's just, you know, mine more water from the ground. Well, that's not a solution, right?
I mean, that's right. It is a finite resource under the ground. You're pulling it out, and eventually there's nothing left in the pool of water down there.
Yeah, and that's why they call it mining, because it's not you're exceeding the renewable capabilities of this resource.
Which reminds me, I mean, you talked about the state engineer being on board with this. All of this is reminiscent of another proposed water project over, well, on the Utah-Nevada line, one that eventually got shelved.
Yeah.
But it would have piped water from the Utah-Nevada line to Vegas. And there are some parallels that people are drawing there, because this was killed because of opposition over groundwater mining and what it might do, but it didn't have the support of the state engineer. What's the difference between that project and this one, Brian?
The difference is here's the difference. The water for the Snake Valley project, which is what it's called. Snake Valley is the valley next to the Wawa Valley, by the way. That water was going to go to Las Vegas. It was taking water from Utah and moving it to Las Vegas. In this case, it's taking water from the same general area and going to Cedar City. That's the only difference, Roger. Other than that, they're pretty much the same thing. And the Vegas project was much bigger, you know. I mean, however, the other part of what killed the Snake Valley proposal was not just the opposition, but Las Vegas figured out, hey, we can use a lot less water. And they have a very aggressive water conservation policies in effect. And their per capita water use has been reduced substantially. It's half what it is in St. George. So, you know, you look at Las Vegas and you can, you know, these enviro groups can say, look at what Vegas has pulled off, or Phoenix or Tucson. They're using a lot less water per capita than we are in Utah. So why don't we try to emulate what they do and shelve these controversial water development projects?
Cedar City, though, and water managers there say that if they don't get access, if they can't tap this source of water, they're not going to be able to grow, and that it will cost them big time. I mean, this is in the environmental impact study.
Yeah, that's what they're saying, Roger, that the economic impact of not getting this water could be pretty profound. But then the other way of looking at it is, well, maybe they should tailor their expectations of growth around available water, as opposed to just grow. I mean, it is a beautiful place around Cedar City. There's a lot of buildable land. However, there is inadequate local water sources. And there is a lot of economic development to be had there in Iron County if the water is available. So I think, yeah, maybe they're right there. But the other question is maybe this isn't the right place to have unrestrained growth.
Wow. Where does this go next, Brian? What are the next steps here? Meaning,
Yeah, that's a good question, Roger. You know, this has been an environmental impact statement that's been in the works over the Trump years. And the document, very long, over 100 pages, got posted by the Environmental Protection Agency on their website. And so that's how I got a copy of it. And it's been signed, it's dated. However, the Bureau of Land Management is the agency who's conducting this environmental impact statement, because it's basically there, it's BLM land that where this groundwater pumping and pipeline would go. And they have not posted it yet on their website, you know, released it to the public for public comment yet. I've never seen that before. And a lot of the people I've interviewed for the story, I've never seen this either, where one federal agency posts a big document, the lead agency doesn't. And so my guess is that they're perhaps they're taking a second look at it before they're putting it out there for public review. But when that does happen, I was told by the BLM it will happen soon, and it will be available for a public comment for a 45-day period, the full public comment window. They'll accept public comment, incorporate that into a final environmental impact statement, and then release a record of decision. Okay. Now that's all months away. But I expect the draft environmental impact statement to get posted any day. That guy, wow. I would have thought it would have been posted a weeks ago.
Well, we'll obviously keep an eye on your reporting for that. One part of this that I don't know if we touched on that I thought was kind of interesting was the fact that the environmental impact study looked at a kind of small region, but that environmental groups say, look, you've got to look at a wider series of basins and how they're interconnected. And I don't know if you want to talk about that, Brian. Yeah.
Yeah, Roger. That is the crux of this issue, I think. It is kind of getting in the weeds, but the Great Basin Water Network has pointed out that, you know, Pine Valley, the aquifer under that runs under it, it basically runs to the north toward the Great Salt Lake. And if you pull water from that, you're affecting aquifers in a much larger region. However, this draft environmental impact statement is basically taking a very narrow look just at Pine Valley. And they've, you know, it's a little box on the map. And so they are faulting the federal agency on this for not taking that broader look of how groundwater pumping in this place will affect what happens two valleys over. And, you know, the state of Utah is kind of looking like a hypocrite here, because that's exactly the argument they use to fight the Snake Valley Water Project, saying, oh, if you pull water from Snake Valley in Nevada, yeah, all the wells will be in Nevada, but you're depleting aquifers far away in Utah, you know? And so now they're kind of ignoring that possibility now that we're talking about moving water from the same general area to a Utah city. So the state kind of looks like they've been talking out of both sides of their mouth here.
Wow. Well, Brian Maffley, public lands and environment reporter with the Salt Lake Tribune, as always, really appreciate your filling us in on these details.
Yeah, anytime, Roger. Take it easy, buddy.
The Salt Lake Tribune's Brian Maffley wrapping up today's Behind the Headlines. That's all the time we have for on the show today. Thanks for tuning in, and join us again next week.